This episode, I'm joined once again by Todd McGowan to discuss his book, Enjoyment, Right and Left. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. Okay, Todd McGowan, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
James, always my pleasure to be here.
We're going to be discussing your book, Enjoyment, Right and Left, which was published 2022, technically 2 years ago already, Sublation Media publisher. And this is a book about enjoyment, pleasure, and politics. Dare I say it, an overarching theory of politics with via a psychoanalytical lens, drawing on your other work from Lacan, Zizek. Is that about right?
Yeah. Would you say I think that's right.
So
that makes it seem a little too ambitious, but I think that's right.
I should say, it's not like a very long book, and yet I think it is very ambitious. But I don't often read political stuff anymore because I've sort of come to my own conclusion is there is no political solution. But I was intrigued as to what, I enjoy your work. So I was intrigued as to what your approach would be. And I think it's applying a theory that still allows for a lot of openness, but I'm not selling it too well. So what is the genesis of the book? And I guess the question is, why did you feel like, okay, I need to try to figure out a theory for right, left, and enjoyment here?
Well, just because I felt like it seemed like the around the world, really, but especially in the U.S., I guess that's because that's my overwhelming preoccupation. But certainly around the world too, these right wing movements seem to be very successful, and it was clear that the more, at least this was clear here, the more that people did to debunk certain claims made by the right-wing movements, the more effective those movements were. So it was a very strange thing that to me, I mean, thought of psychoanalytically, I guess it's not so strange, but the more it just in a commonsensical way, it seemed very strange. And so I thought, well, it seems important to try to say something about that and why that might be so, and why it might be so that we are in favor. I think this is true across the spectrum, actually, that we support movements that don't have our own interests at heart, really. And I think that that's something that, I don't know, I feel like that was the thing that needed to be said, I guess, is why I tried to say it. And I was trying to work it out for myself. I felt like I didn't have a full theory myself. And I thought, well, how can I make it all come together? And that's what I tried to do in the book, and the way you described it made it seem, I didn't mean to make it that ambitious, but I guess it did become that. I don't think what you're saying is wrong. Like, I think that I was trying to have a theory of why we do what we do politically and through the category of enjoyment as a way to think about it.
Well I guess what I'd add to that is I realized after I said it it transforms the book into something particularly possibly that it's not. Like, there is this overarching theory, but it's not sort of like Hobbesian in the sense of like, right, this is, this is it. I think there's still a lot of openness there. I guess one question to start is, what are your politics? Do you have a specific ism? If someone says, what's your political standing? Can you go, I am da da da?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I obviously would identify with, I would say that I'm a leftist, but the term that I'd like to use for myself, and I would call myself an egalitarian. That's how I think of myself, which is, I know it's not a trendy term and maybe that doesn't even make sense to people, but I really think that those terms I still really identify with those terms from the French Revolution. And, so the second one is really important to me.
Is that fraternity, liberty?
Liberté, égalité.
Okay.
Fraternité, yeah.
Mm. So you said that people, I'm already jumping around from the questions that I sent you, but you said there at the beginning that people follow political movements that don't have our interests at heart. What are our interests?
Well, just our interest of advancing this is a term people, so for one thing, our survival. That would be the basic interest. or are good. So our whatever would allow us to, this is the term people like to use today, whatever would allow us to flourish. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are invested politically against our own flourishing. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to work out in this book.
Well, at risk of repetition, because people I think are often reluctant to say what politics would look like almost empirically, almost visually, you know, what would a world look like to you that's flourishing?
I don't want it to flourish.
You don't want it to flourish?
No, I'm against flourishing, right? I'm against interest.
You want people to be miserable?
Well, here's what I think. I think that the belief in flourishing and I think it fails to see that all flourishing has the cost of a certain suffering, right? Like to me, that's the basic psychoanalytic Hegelian dialectical idea, right? That if you want flourishing, fine, but you got to pay for it with a pound of flesh. And so so it's hard for me to think of a utopia, but I would say I have a certain anti-dystopia, which would be a world in which everybody, I think my definition of evil is that people want other people to suffer for their excess, their enjoyment.
Yeah,
right?
But they never say that explicitly, right?
No. They don't say that explicitly. But I would say, like, my idea of an anti-dystopia, but not utopia, it would be you suffer for your own enjoyment. Like, you pay the price for your own. So that's what I think. And I think that one of the things about capitalism is that it tries to push that suffering, that lack onto the other. And you think like, oh, I'm going to have this pure enjoyment or pure excess for myself. Right. So that would be my anti-dystopia.
No, it makes sense. There's a lot there to unpack, but you did use the word enjoyment. Now, enjoyment is a word personally that I really like. So I was like, man, he's taken like that to me is one of the trickiest. The optimistic terms are the trickiest, most sometimes obnoxious terms, because I think this notion that you said of flourishing in relation to like Western notions of progress at the moment of, you know, what is our telos as individuals is progress is happiness is the classic one, which is stuck in pursuit of happiness. And people think that their life would be perfect if you know, they never got ill, there was no death and et cetera, et cetera. So this term enjoyment is like, I'm you know, if someone says to me, like, what do you enjoy? It's my least favorite question because I, without seeming like some pretentious pessimist, I genuinely can't answer, what I enjoy because I think it's a moment. If it is a thing, it's a momentary thing that you can't poke at it. But you're taking it on.
I'm kind of redefining it. Yeah, okay.
So what's enjoyment? What's enjoyment?
So enjoyment for me is what keeps you going through the day, right? So it's not this like moment of, I think I would define what you're talking about as pleasure. And for me, enjoyment is what I was just describing, like this excess that has like suffering in it that can't, you know, that if it's a pleasure, it's a pleasure that you suffer through, right?
So like it's sort not of like a, if you're trying to read Lacan.
Exactly. Like I think that's pretty good. Like Lacan reading, there's a certain enjoyment in that precisely because of its the recalcitrance of the text to me. I think Freud in a way was the last line of studies on hysteria when he's like, we're not trying to create happiness. We're just trying to transform hysterical misery into common human unhappiness. And I've always thought like that's a pretty good goal, I think, for, you know, like even for a society, like, can we create just common human unhappiness instead of abject misery? But I don't think it's the problem is that's not a great rallying cry for politics. You said you're disaffected with politics. And I kind of am too, to that extent. Like, I think that our rallying cry should be like common human unhappiness, you know, shared suffering, these kind of things.
We're going to suffer, but better. We're going to get better.
Better suffering. Yeah.
Like the Hope poster, but it says suffer.
Yeah.
That would be great. I still wouldn't vote, but.
Right. There you go.
Okay. Well, before we get deep into the political angle, I do want to just stay on that. I mean, so do you think where we've gone wrong then, just in a sentence, is that we, by your own definitions, we're heading we believe we should head towards pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like in the way, in my terminology, yeah. my jargon, like I think we think about pleasure and we forget about our enjoyment, which is the pleasure that we suffer, right? Like the link between sacrifice and excess, to put it. Mm. In, yeah. So I think we want the one without the other. That's what I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So do you, without, I guess, you know, it's difficult to speak for so many other people. I'm using the royal we a bit, you know, we, the word we, which I personally don't like in politics. So I'm using it a lot here. But do you think then there's a paradox that people who, when people state that they want pleasure or that they are experiencing pleasure, that they're not, you kind of can't, there's like a paradox in pleasure that really you're not.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Right. I think that that's what Freud's getting at with his notion of beyond of a pleasure principle, right? Even on the last page of that book, he says, it turns out that the pleasure principle serves the death drive. And I think death drive is the way that pleasure is. That's another term, a psychoanalytic term for how enjoyment is mobilized, right? Like it's like this continual pursuit of failure. But it's obviously you're not consciously pursuing it. And so that's what you're getting at is consciously we're pursuing pleasure, but unconsciously we're actually undoing the pleasure that we think we're consciously pursuing. Mm. Right? Like I like to think I love sports, but I like to think of this in terms of sports. Like you think like, oh, I want my team to win whatever, the championship. Mm. But what you really want is the way that they're struggling to win the championship. Absolutely. Like winning it is like, okay, they've won and then it's over. Mm. And it's a momentary pleasure. But then the enjoyment of the team winning is really all the setbacks that occur on the way to that victory, which is why I think this is true of every sports fan. The most memorable things are the missed championships, not the actual ones that were won.
And that's a perfect segue, it really is, into the politics, because that form of tribalism that you find in sports teams, which often results in, you know, I mean, all the elements are there, right? Tribalism, alienation, violence, hostility, reaction. That process seems to mirror the political process. And so within the political process, are you saying, well, you know, I'm saying that it mirrors it. Would you agree that it mirrors it in the sense that your argument is for the right? Those setbacks, those reactions, they're constant. I mean, that's pretty much all the right does these days is wait for a left-wing person, figure to tweet, and then they go, right, they get to react. Yeah. Yeah, so that's what, is that what's bolstering the right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure, for sure. I mean, you mentioned Hobbes before. Mm. I mean, Hobbes seems like, to me, the great philosopher of right-wing politics, because it's all about that, right? It's all about that, like, everything is like this struggle against the other side, and if you and that's where that's where the enjoyment of that kind of political struggle is located. Precisely. I mean, your example is exactly correct. I mean, that is the form that enjoyment takes. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, one of the points I make in the book is that if people on the left engage in the same kind of thing, then they're fighting really a right wing. They're engaging in a right-wing kind of politics. I mean, that's one of the wagers of the book, right? That there is a different possibility that what you called tribalism, that's already, once you see it as tribalism, you're already seeing it in a right-wing
reaction, fashion. Reactionary.
Yeah. 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 Reaction.
So,
yeah.
So the right-wing form of enjoyment is that sort of, is built against something, on against someone, against another, is like constant need of borders. So what's the left-wing form of enjoyment?
Well, that, I mean, the idea is that the left-wing form of enjoyment is universal, that but in a way it's enjoying the same thing, because the universal is not just, oh, everyone is included. It's universal is actually what we all share is this position of being excluded. So the very thing that the right wants to do is to attack those that are excluded, right? But in reality, they're getting off on, to use the talk about it in terms of enjoyment, they're getting off on the exclusion. Yeah. And my point is that what the left should see is that exclusion is universal. Like no one, and that's why I think that's why people so energetically try to make it clear that they're in, because that, you know, that exclusion or non-belonging, it's actually universal. And everybody, I mean, if you've ever been like, I don't, to me, that's a great example. You go to a party, you feel like, wow, everybody else is there here. Like they fit in, they're having a good time. I'm kind of the oddball. I don't, but I think the problem is, the point is that everyone feels like that at the party, mm-hmm. right? That everybody feels like that when they're wherever. And I think that that's the universality of non-belonging that I identify with less.
And that never, so that, to use the party metaphor, is there ever going to be a point where the party transforms to a state of full belonging?
No, I think that's the point, right? Like belonging can never be full. Belonging can never be
There'll always be someone who doesn't belong. There will always be
And in fact, there'll always be everyone that doesn't belong.
Always be everyone.
Like that's
what do you mean by that?
Like,
what do you mean? There'll always be everyone that doesn't belong. Is that so? Like, so this is less political, more psychoanalytical, would you say?
I think it's both, right?
Okay.
Because I think the leftist project, if it exists, has to be based on this idea that there can't be. And so I think the liberal project is let's get everyone in, right? Let's create a state of universal belonging where everyone is included, right? Here in the U.S., we have these initiatives at all the universities. They're called DEI, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion. And so this, and to me, that's like the great idea, right? Like we can fit everyone in. We can bring everyone. It's like you said, we can eliminate all political dissent because everybody can come in. But I think the leftist dream is actually, no, we can get everyone out and we can give up this fantasy that we could actually belong. So I think that not only can not everyone belong, but that really no one can feel like they belong, which is why I think they need to so vociferously say that person does, I belong because that person doesn't, right? Like that's why I think immigrants are such a, that drives people crazy, because if someone can immigrate into the country, then that immediately calls into question, like, wait a minute, my own belonging, am I that secure in it? Like someone else can just come in, join. I really don't feel like I'm really belong. And so I think that the attack on the immigrant is an attempt to assert, like, I really belong.
But it's maybe not Emperor's New Clothes, but it's like Wizard of Oz, right? Because in the immigration, suddenly the problem of like where you were before becomes a, you know, oh, actually, no, this is, I don't know, Britain for the British. But if the immigration wasn't there, the question of the initial original belonging is, you know, fairy dust.
Right. Exactly.
So, we constantly need scapegoat. I mean, there's tons of other
language. To assert our own belonging, right? Like to assert your own belonging, because it's never secure.
No.
It's never secure.
And that do you in the sense that you say no one will ever belong, like no one at all belongs, is that sort of, in a way, it almost seems like capitalism is one of the operative functions there, in the sense that it's accelerating it into the sense, in a way of, you know, Rudolf Steiner says, it's a quote that I think about a lot, but Rudolf Steiner says, in the future, everyone will have their own religion. So eventually, like, it'll just be, it'll be billions of individuals all alienated from each other. Is that the future?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah, I think that's true. So I think that, but doesn't capitalism do two things at once? Like it like enforces this non-belonging, like it makes you, but at the same time, it holds out the promise of you get the right commodity, then you can really feel like you belong. So I think it has a double effect, really.
Do you think that will ever break though? Because just even in the span of my lifetime, this treadmill of like, next identity, like that's moving by the minute. Do you think that will ever?
Yeah, I mean, the question, I think you're, it's a great question, right? Like, will it just collapse of its own hyper speed? Yeah, or hubris, right. Like, possibly, right? Like, I think that is, I mean, I think that the one thing is like, the identities are essentially dissatisfying. So there's a point at which that gets, that you circle through, and like, although it doesn't seem to be true of the people that accumulate the most commodities, right? They seem eager for to get more. So it doesn't seem like there's not this recognition on the part of like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. Wow, commodities inherently unsatisfying. I'm going to like give up the accumulation of them.
No one ever says they're done.
No one ever says that.
No one ever says that. Well, a few people do, but do you think if they, I do believe people can sincerely, you know, make that decision. But do you think when they make that decision, they're almost a non-entity now? Just they don't matter anymore.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think it's true that I think you, because it seems, I think this is, that it seems psychotic to people. Like if you're in the capitalist universe and you like give up that, like, or, you know, like another way this manifests itself is branding, right? Like if you're not branding yourself or constantly looking for your edge, I think you, it's like, just like you're saying, like, I think you become a non-entity to people.
Is that, do you think that's non-political? Do you think you can truly be non-political?
No. I mean, I know you want to be, but I don't think.
Oh, no, I don't think I am. I think, you know, as much as I'm not massive on Foucault, I am somewhat in agreement with him with, you know, homo economicus and in a way homo politicus of like, look, once that's instantiated in society, you can't get away from
it. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think that there's ever been a society where people haven't been political. I just think we're now aware of it, maybe in a way that people weren't before. Because you're one way or another, you're invested in like the way the whole society is going.
Mm-hmm.
It can be just by quietly going along. That's fine. I mean, that's what most people do, and that seems fine to me. But I think, or it can be like trying to change the direction of the ship. But I think you can't. I think you're always going to be affecting it.
Mm. So you're very, you're obviously very, you know, Lacan is your trajectory and Zizek.
You know, I think Hegel more, a little bit Hegel more, but, okay. But yeah, look, I've kind of distanced myself a little from Lacan.
Okay.
I have
I'm
to.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. In part because I wrote this, I just finished. Do you know my friend Mari Rudy who died in this last year?
No.
Anyway, I was going to, she coaxed me into writing this, like Cambridge introduction to Lacan with her.
Right.
And then she died before she finished any of her part. And so I just have spent the last year finishing it. And it kind of like, that was enough.
You finally had to spend too much time with him.
Yeah, I felt like I did. Like, I felt like there's like a little period where I think he was really right. But then there's this other stuff that it's hard for me to take. So,
okay. Well, where I was going to go with that. I mean,
sorry.
It's fine. Maybe we could bring in Hegel on it instead. In a way, is, you know, because this is all constantly fluxing, and as we've said, at the moment that someone does sincerely stop, which I do believe is a possibility, but at the moment someone does say basically the horrible words "I'm content," they dissipate. They're gone.
Yeah.
I guess this is a psychoanalytical question and a social question, because it seems that what's being built, what's being crystallized, is something that's always in movement, like new identity, keep up with it, or keep up with the left, the eternal long non-belonging, or keep up with the right, the eternal reaction. Is there something beneath that? Is there a point where we could say, you know what, I'm going to create a political movement, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to try form something from, like, you know, a true core, a real, but this is why I was mentioning Lacan, because all, you know, all his language, you know, that the difficulty of like getting through to whatever term you want to use for it throughout philosophy, you know, the soul, the real, the essence, doesn't seem to be that here politically. It seems like all these movements are constantly in dialectic.
Yeah. I mean, I just would say, I guess, the vision that I have of what I would call left is, I guess for me, that idea of non-belonging is universal and is the core. Like, that is what, to me, that's the nature of subjectivity. Like, so that's the, if you want to put it in Lacan's jargon, like, that's the real of subjectivity is our non-belonging, like our, this like internal fissure with ourselves, our alienation, the way we can't feel at home somewhere, right? Like that to me, like, I guess my idea would be, well, that can actually be the basis of your political position as a subject, right? Like that doesn't necessarily have to be, and I don't think it's, I mean, it, when you use the term dialectic, I mean, I guess that's dialectical in relation to the other things, but I don't know. I feel like there's something sort of foundational about that.
Mm-hmm. Is revolution a psychoanalytic impossibility?
Maybe no, I don't. Why would you say that? Why did you say that?
Why would you say that? Well, revolution is the peak. It's the climax. We're done. Yeah. Do leftists truly want revolution? I'm using that fairly abstractly. My appreciation of leftism is probably like speaking to someone who hasn't read the recent updates and things. But I still attend to I guess what would probably call classic. Like my understanding is classical Marxist of like proletariats against the bourgeoisie, trying to seize the means of production through to a revolution, through to a world of without private property and you know, equality. But from what we've been talking about, the revolution seems that it would, at one and the same time, stop the non-belonging, which is the irony of, like, it's a non-belonging, which is a belonging, but also open up the expanse for complete non-belonging. But it seems like the revolution is the point from which suffering begins to exit the picture.
Maybe that's the problem, right? I think that maybe is the problem with the image of revolution, right? Okay. As a leftist image, right? Like maybe, I mean, I'm not attached to it. Like I don't think that needs to. I mean, I think there were clearly, like, both in France and in Haiti, there were revolutions that created a fundamental shift in the way people related to the world. Like all of a sudden, slavery didn't seem to be in Haiti. I'm thinking like slavery didn't need to, was it ceased to be a natural phenomenon, right? Like it's the ground shifting beneath people's feet. But I think your point is maybe right that like there is this dream attached to the idea of revolution that will be the end of our, like that marks the end of our epoch of suffering. And I think that is to me problematic. I don't necessarily have an attachment to revolution. Okay. Like, I don't think it's, because I think you're right. There is something a little anti-psychoanalytic about it because it suggests like once we'll get to a certain point and then after that point, everything is going to be different. Right. And there's not going to be this, we're still not going to relate to this thing that we're carrying within us. And I think I mean, there's something I don't know. I'm divided on what, in your question, because something about it, I do think is true. Like, I do think there can be these moments, even individually, right, where you're going along a certain way, and then just you make a cut, and then you're able to go in a totally different path. So I do think that's possible. But I think the image of revolution, I agree with you, is too, what's too inscribed in it is this idea of like we're gonna start a new epoch where there's no longer any of this suffering that's characterized the previous ones.
Do you think so? Avoidance, avoidance of suffering is actually just that. Do you think it's always avoidance? It's always
obviously there are times when suffering is excessive. Like, you know, when little kids are working in a factory, like, you know, clearly that's not, if you want to try to get rid of that, you're not just avoiding suffering, no. Like trying to, you know, but I do think a lot of time that is true.
What about Buddhists?
I hesitate to talk about Buddhism just because I have Buddhist friends that are absolutely convinced that Buddhism and psychoanalysis are just exactly intertwined. And their point is it's not about the elimination of suffering. So I think that I usually hate this answer, but I think Buddhism is too multiple for me to say a definitive thing about it. But I think to the extent, I will answer this way. To the extent that Buddhism wants to get rid of suffering, then that seems to me phantasmatic. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Yeah.
Mm. So your appreciation of politics then thus far is, it seems in a way, anti-political in the socio-political sense. This is falling all over the place, but when people vote for someone, they want something. They want, like, this is going to happen. It rarely ever does.
Yeah.
it seems anti-political in the sense that you're stating this is never going to stop. There's never going, there isn't utopia. There is not going to be a utopia. This is all, it's all a bit of a game in a way to bolster some sense of belonging or some sense of belonging or some sense of feeling alienated. That's kind of it. I mean, it's
right. And and for me, the question is, which are you? Well, that, if you mean by real politics, like electoral politics, then I don't really so much care about that.
No.
Right. Like, yeah, I just don't. Like, I think, because I think at the base of that is this other kind of thing, right? Like to me, like electoral politics follows from the position that you have relative to the structure of enjoyment, mm-hmm. right? Like that's the whole, in a certain sense, that's the whole point of the book that I wrote, mm-hmm. right? Like that's the idea.
Would you agree that people's affiliation and engagement in politics at its absolute foundation is their belief that in engaging in whatever political current they're within will at a future date increase their security?
No.
What?
No. I think they might consciously, unconsciously believe that.
What is that? What is, why affiliate? Why make those decisions to say, right, I'm following this? I mean, obviously we've done the left and right, but what is it, you know, that just seems to be in the general engagement generally, you know, yeah. Why do we make these decisions?
Well, I think it's how can I find a way to structure my, I'm going to use my jargony term again, to structure my enjoyment, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's the fundamental reason why they invent, like they go to the ballot box or they go join the political party. I think like they're like, oh, this gives me a way to make sense of how I want to imagine the world structured in a way that I can enjoy. And I think it's not about security to me. It's about how can I find a way to structure without knowing it, how I'm going to damage myself, right? How I'm going to structure my own suffering, to put it in those terms again.
Politics is inherently masochistic?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Do we always, if we don't engage in politics, we abstractly do engage, but you know, in some other form, sports, everyone has a masochism?
I think so. Yeah, because I think the basic structure of our enjoyment is masochism.
What's your masochism? How do you upset yourself?
Oh my God. James, yeah. I mean, I didn't even sleep last night. I'm like a complete insomniac. Like I spend like 3 days of the week with zero sleep. That's my number one way. So, but the sports is another way. Like I managed to back teams that never are successful.
It's an unconscious decision though. Is that what you're saying?
No, absolutely. I consciously think let's go.
But you consciously think let's go. But I mean, it's difficult to speak of your own unconscious, but do you think there is a point there where you're going, but I kind of know that there, I'm going to, in the future,
absolutely.
I get to engage in that misery, in that struggle, and say next year, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the problem is that you can't, while it's happening, say, oh, I really like the team that I support, the championship of American football, the Super Bowl, right? Like, they lost 2 years ago. They lost the Super Bowl. Now, in a way, that was like crucial to my enjoyment. But at that time, I couldn't sleep. I was devastated, devastated. Mm. So I couldn't say to myself, oh, don't worry. Like unconsciously, this is really what you were desiring.
So
like,
yeah.
I couldn't say that.
You'd have
ruined it.
Well, you'd have ruined the enjoyment, right?
Right. Why? Because there has to be a kind of fetishistic disavowal of the, like, you can't, like, think, like, you know, Pascal, I don't even quote this in here. Pascal has this line that everyone wants to be happy, even the man who hangs himself still does it because he wants to be. So I think consciously that's true, but unconsciously, I don't think we are striving to be happy at all. And so, but I don't think you can bring that awareness into consciousness, except after the fact. After the fact, you can. I can say, oh, well, yeah, look at what I did. You know, like, I clearly, I needed them to lose in order to keep my libidinal economy functioning in the way that it does, right? So I can do it after the fact, but I in the when you're in the thing, you can't, there's no way you can.
If we
just like, I mean, like, isn't sex the same, right? Like, isn't this, like, you think like, oh, I'm going to find this perfectly, a romance, whatever, satisfying partner, I'm striving for, you don't think like, oh, wow, this person has exactly the kind of defects that are good, that I like in a, that I psychically am drawn to in a partner. No one thinks that, right? No one, you think it can be a way of like getting oneself to sustaining the relationship going, okay, look, the things that you think are a defect are actually what you're drawn to and you should stay with this person, maybe. Right. But you can't think, you know, one thinks that in the beginning, right? You couldn't think.
No.
I think, right?
Or, I completely agree. I'm just thinking of some fictional world where, you know, you go to whatever it might be. I mean, Trump rally is probably the most apt aesthetic right now, considering a lot of people, it does seem likely that he'll be reelected.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about that.
But it's I think he's going to be elected. I agree.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because Biden actually lacks
Biden mobilize
lacks enough substance to it's like trying to engage with air. You know, like
right. Well, I think he doesn't. I think Biden is fine. Actually, I mean, this Israel thing has been a disaster. But I think generally, as a president, I think he's been fine. But I think actually that hurts him. Like, I think he doesn't. I think what you just said is right, and I think he doesn't. Like, does anyone feel like Biden is mobilizing their enjoyment? No, I don't think anyone feels that way. Right? Like, even the people that support him, they don't feel like, wow, I'm really. Well, unlike like Barack Obama, like he as a rhetorician, as a political operative, he was able to mobilize people's enjoyment in a way that was incredible, right? Like areas of the U.S. that voted for him like 60-40 are now for Trump 60-40. So it's like an incredible kind of turnaround, I think.
So for Biden,
go ahead.
Sorry, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think I would just chalk it all up to this mobilization of enjoyment. Like, that's what Trump is able to do, and Biden can, and Obama was able to do.
With Biden, there's almost like you don't feel, what is it people are belonging to or not belonging to? Or what's, you know, where's,
right,
very abstractly, like, what lines are being drawn where you go, we're trying to get over here or we're here? There's nothing tangible.
No, there's nothing tangible. Right.
I think you used the perfect word there, right? Like, probably the most dangerous word in politics is to say, yeah, they're fine. Because it's kind of not, that's right. Nothing.
I agree. Right.
So what's Trump, and I think, doing? I mean, it's just. Sorry, I keep interrupting.
No, right. He's just technocratic. I mean, that's the other thing that you could, one way you could describe it, I think, right? And it gives people no reason to support it.
So what's Trump doing right? Not that you support him, but what's he doing
right? No, clearly I don't support him. Right. Clearly I don't support him. Yeah, but I think he's really good, I think, at saying things that go beyond what is acceptable. And I think that is one way that he shows that he's a figure who enjoys himself, right? Like, he doesn't allow, and I think this is why people identify with him. I think people that, and I think it doesn't matter how much you have when you go to, in fact, I think most people that go to Trump rallies are not, they're not impoverished, but they're not. They're like middle, lower class. They're not. It's not the upper class that's going to a Trump rally. It would be gauche, I think, for them. But I think that that you identify with him, and you identify. And I think one of the things that you identify with is the challenge to the elites, right? Like, I think he's great at this. And that's why I think the more that he gets criticized by the New York Times or by the Washington Post or by for university professors like me. The more that he gets criticized, the more it becomes libidinally appealing to vote for him. It's just, I think it's absolutely true. Like this recent primary in Iowa, right? Like he just did incredibly well. And the more that there was this kind of New York Times backing of Nikki Haley, the opponent, the more support went to Trump. And that's, I think that's just going to be, I think he's going to romp through this primary, and I think Biden's going to have a lot of trouble in the election. I think I think it was dumb to keep Biden. I mean, it was just so ridiculous of him to stay on the ticket. Like, I think they're actually, they're not well known around the world, but I think there are some alternative Democratic candidates that would have been pretty appealing and actually have managed on a state level to mobilize the enjoyment of their constituents.
So this notion of Trump against the elites is, I mean, it's, to me, it's completely it's sort of confusing in a way, because it seems fairly transparent, though the right doesn't want to hear it, that when you look at Trump, I just can't see how anyone can believe that he is in any sense a difference, right? That he in any sense isn't within that, even though it seems a primarily an aesthetic difference, if there's any. Going back to some sort of like Americana, I don't know, empire type thing. But he is an elite. He's just not one of the elites that he talks about. I mean, he's completely within that. So what is it that, in relation to your theory of enjoyment, what is it that the supporters of Trump aren't seeing?
Well, yeah, what are they not? I mean, I think that they don't make the connection you just did, James, I don't think. Like, I don't think that for them, I think the aesthetics is really important. Like, I think it's not just aesthetics, because I think he doesn't look like, I mean, even the things that seem from a, whatever that means, elite perspective, that seem untoward on his part, like the orange hair, the tanning bed tan, like all those things. I think that they actually add to his appeal among his supporters, and but from the perspective of from this whatever elite perspective, I think it seems like, how can that be appealing? So I think these aesthetic things that differentiate him from the other rest of the wealthy, I think is actually, that's crucial to what his appeal is. You know, like, I don't think those things are nothing. Like, I think they're, but I mean, a couple things you said are great. Like, policy wise, he's not, I mean, there are ways in which he's not like, he is not doctrinaire like a typical American conservative. Like, one of the ways he attacked Nikki Haley was, she's going to try to take away your Social Security, I'm going to protect it. So there are things that he will side more with the working class than the traditional American Republican. So that is, I think, I don't think that's nothing. But I also think that I think there's a divide in the U.S. between wealth elite and cultural elitism. And I think being elite in terms of wealth is not seen as, it's not seen as elite. It's seen, you can be very wealthy and still part of the people.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're culturally elite, you're alienated.
That's spot on. That's on the difference. So it almost seems like policies don't matter.
Right. Policy means nothing. Right. Nothing, I think. Except a few of these things. Like I do think the one or two little things where he's like, I'm on the side of the worker, I'm not going to take away the pension of all workers. Yeah. But basically,
these are fantasies though, right? Because I haven't really seen any of, other than, you know, I'm not some like massively anti-Trump person. I just sort of look at politics from like, okay. Like thing I did see, the human trafficking, like he did overhaul human trafficking when he was in office. But other than that, politics seems to me that just nothing changes except the aesthetic. Like, it's a very cynical view, but it's more just my own experience of probably living in the UK, that I've never seen a policy and gone out into the world and been able to go, huh, there's that policy. Like, this is all this fantasy of people like, oh, they're going to do that. It's all future-based.
Well, but you don't think that Thatcher made substantive changes in British society when she came into power?
Oh, I'm only 29. I know I look like...
Okay.
I know I look like I was alive when Thatcher was in power, but I actually wasn't.
Okay. All right. There we go. I mean, I guess I'm just older. Sorry.
It's fine.
I didn't even think that you're alive, but I do think that she... I mean, I think that would be an example of someone... I mean, that seems like a recent thing. Like, I think... And it is true that even when... I mean... I guess in America, there are a couple ways that Trump affected things, right? Like the border thing, he did nothing, which I think is important, right? Like, I think he campaigned on this border wall. We're going to stop illegal immigration. And everybody complains about it under Biden. But Trump did nothing to slow it down or stop it because he actually needs that as a problem.
That's exactly what I was about to say is, do you think the mistake, the task of a politician from their own point of view is to actually not allow the fantasies to become realities? Like it's the, you know, we could draw on so many films here, but Vertigo, Perfect Woman, like eventually has to die because it's now in reality, right? So it's like, like I'll build a wall, but like it can't really do it because then it could fail, right?
Or even if it succeeded, like I think nightmare for Trump would be if it succeeded, then like why isn't America great again? We've kept all the immigrants out, and now we don't have enough workers to support all our retirees. So because our birth rate is like 1.7 for every woman, which is not a sustainable rate. So what are we going to do? This is true in Europe. It's true everywhere, right? Like without immigration, there's not enough. There's not even there's not enough labor force to pay for the people that are retired. So there would be an economic disaster if he really did what he's saying. So, but put aside that if it failed or succeeded, disaster, right?
Okay. Tough question then. Do you think from the mindset of a politician and I guess all the, you know, the candidates or whatever, their meeting rooms, their groups, do you think it's a conscious decision that they not that they're literally having meetings, like how can we make it seem like we're doing this, but then still not do it? But do you think there's actually an unconscious element to them hampering their own things they say they want, which is
it's just like me with the football team.
Yeah,
like I don't think it's any different than that.
Oh, wow.
I don't think it's any different. Yeah, but I think they're consciously trying their best. You know, they're like Trump isn't in there going like, "How can we screw up this border wall so it doesn't?"
Exactly. That's what I mean. So it's intriguing as to why it doesn't happen then.
Right.
Why politics doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, the one time they actually did what they wanted. Mm. This is abortion, right? Like Trump changed the Supreme Court. They overthrew Roe v. Wade, and then it was a total political disaster for the right in the U.S. So it's exactly proof of this thing that don't let your animating fantasy, like the Vertigo example is great. Don't let your animating fantasy become true. If it does, you better kill it, right? Like that's the
It can't happen.
It
also reminds me of. So, would you say? I mean, many people might not have seen this film because it's not that well known. But Zizek, I only know of it because Zizek did his. It was in one of his films. The film Seconds, right? So.
It's not that well known, but it's a great movie.
It's a fantastic film. Very briefly, the film Seconds is a man pays this company to quite literally have his whole body. But it just physically body change, so he is like his complete fantasy ideal person. But of course, inside, psychoanalytically, mentally, he is still him. So he has to. This seems to be what's happening in politics. Well, people, if people got their way, this is what would happen. The whole edifice will have to crumble.
Right. I mean, it comes back to that question of revolution, right? Like, Seconds is an anti-revolution film because it's basically saying. I mean, he can't do it. We'll just give away the end of the film. Like, he goes to this new life, and the only rule of the new life is you can't try to reconnect with your old life.
Mm.
And if you do, you're going to be killed. And he can't help himself. He reconnects his old life, and then they end up killing him at the end. So I think that's the idea is you can't get rid of that stubborn attachment to that thing, right? And completely change and over into the new thing. Is that the idea of that film? I think
it is. Yeah, no, I think it is. But it seems to me that also would conclude that psychoanalysis is largely a pessimistic endeavor. I mean, we get somewhere, but I think it's something that therapy struggles with in general of if we're sitting down and doing this thing, well, what is the teleology? But at the same time, to plant a flag and say, you're going to become this, that's really dangerous as well. So
I don't think you can do that.
No.
Yeah.
No.
But I think you can say, like, how can you find a way? I mean, I think it's not really that much more than recognizing, right? Like, can you recognize how you're, like, I think, you know, we've talked about this, like, these self-sabotaging mechanisms, right? Like, can you recognize that you're really doing that? Or do you think this is just this thing that keeps happening to me? I don't know what's going on. Like, why does it keep happening? Well, I keep, you know, I keep finding the wrong person. I keep getting involved with the wrong person again and again and again.
Yeah.
Well, isn't psychoanalysis just there to say, well, actually, you're doing that. You're
but that's about as far as it can go. I mean, just to put it on,
I agree.
Put it on a very basic level, like even losing weight or not, you know, if you're trying to cut back on sugar, it's astounding that you can recognize this very easily. You go to the store, you put all your healthy food in, you get to the checkout, and then it's like, I don't know, what was the thing you enjoyed last time? A creamy or?
Yeah, creamy. Creamy. Yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
it is, for me, it's an iced bun at the moment. But like, they're always like, they obviously put them on the checkout.
They're right at the thing.
But then your mind's going, when you're at home, you said you wouldn't buy these this year. You're not going to buy them. But then something else, like the unconscious is like, yeah, but let me just get your hand. And then, and I know I'm doing it the whole time, right? So, that's like as far as psychoanalysis can get, it seems.
I agree. Totally.
Do you think that's pessimistic or do you think that's
I don't think it's, I think it's a kind of like, it's not optimistic, right? No. That's for sure. But I don't think it's pessimistic. Like, I think in a way, psychoanalysis is saying, look at the way, even in these failed things, that you're actually deriving satisfaction from. Like, even that thing that you're doing when you're at the in the checkout line, you're like you could go home and just go, oh my god, I suck, I can't just fight, I don't have any discipline. But if you, like, psychoanalysis would allow you to say, like, oh well, you know what, I found satisfaction in doing this thing that seemed like a failure. And so I think in a way it allows us to re-see our failures in a new light. So it's not just like, it allows us to see the success in failure, right? That we otherwise wouldn't see. So that's why I'm a little hesitant to say it's pessimistic.
Sure. Because of absolutely. I mean, to draw on another Zizek title of, you know, Lacan, enjoy your symptom. That's my own symptom with the ice band. What's the political symptom? You know, like at a political rally, what are the symptoms that we're seeing there?
Well, maybe the symptom is security, right? Like, I think that's what you mentioned earlier, or like prosperity, right? These kinds of things. I think those are the things that I guess those are the ideals that we succumb to. I mean, what would the symptom be in the political rally? I don't know. That's maybe, I don't think that answer is right. Like, I think that in a way, the symptom is maybe Trump is the symptom, right? Like, maybe Trump is the symptom of the age, right? Like, he arises as this, I think, in a response to, like you could say that Trump is a response to Biden, right? I know that chronologically that doesn't make sense, but just in terms of like the very thing that you were mentioning about how no one, like I said, he's fine. You're like, that's the damning word about the politician. Like, I think that in a way, that's the fine. Like, I think that was true of Hillary Clinton as well. Like, I think that's why Hillary Clinton lost to Trump, is because she was fine. She was just like, there was no, and I remember the campaign so distinctly. It was just, her campaign slogan was, I'm with her. And so what did that even mean? Like, what are you proposing? Like, this, you could say, like, this absence of a political program where we're going to really try to do something. Like, when you just said, look, the political point, nothing ever changes in the political, like, no matter who's like, to me, isn't Trump the symptom of that? Like, it doesn't, that, don't people look to Trump? They're like, well, at least he's going to shake things
absolutely
up.
I mean, so many people, this is the thing. So many people voted for Trump the first time, and they, you know, you look at the data on this, explicitly said, I voted for him because it was like, the whole thing has been blue. Like, I don't mean this in political colors. You know, the world's been blue for years, and I'm so bored. I don't even care if red is bad. I don't care. I just want something different.
So many people
vote for Trump for those reasons.
But the thing is, I think that still holds today.
Even more, like, so, I think it seems.
Even more.
Because the blue came back, like, even more fine.
Even more, right. Like, because I think that's really right, James, because under Obama, there was still this kind of like, even if the response to the 2008 financial crisis was baleful, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there still was something about him that seemed not like just politics as ordinary, or politics as just everything's the same. But under Biden, I think that's all you think. And I don't know. I don't really have like as a liberal, as a Democrat, I think he's been fine. Like, I don't really think, like, I know a lot of friends are like Biden, Darp, but I don't know what they could point to that has been, other than, again, the way that he's dealt with Israel and Palestine. But I don't, so I don't, I'm not, I, it's not, again, about him personally, except insofar as he doesn't, you know, there's, and, but I think it's tied to this lack of a policy, this lack of a, like, look, this is the clear direction I want to take things. It means this, right?
So, that word fine, yeah, though, it's so interesting, right? Because if you think about that, even on the individual subject level, if you go to the, you know, go to the psychoanalyst, how's your week been? Fine. If it has been like fine, depression's more interesting, you know, like,
right, it's much more fuel, interesting.
We want fuel always to be doing things, right?
So, I know, right? Depression would be better.
Is that where the self-sabotage begins?
It's absolutely, like, you know, right,
I can't,
right,
even
absolutely
stand being fine. This sucks,
right? Right, like, you need something to like liven it up, yeah, right? Like, I think, you know, my spouse Hillary Neroni, she's also a theorist, she said she has a clear theory of violence, that we resort to violence to make things interesting for ourselves. Mm. And I think it's not bad, right? Like, I think there's something to that. Like, there's like these violent, like, why do these violent outbursts occur? Like, because it makes things, it interrupts the quotidian, right? Like, it breaks things up. And I think that I think there's something to that, really. I think that's, in a way, I think that's one of the real interventions of psychoanalysis. That's one of its real discoveries.
Where do you see this, you know, following Trump's likely election? If I had to put money on it, it would definitely be Trump right now.
So would I, yeah.
But further into the future, I don't know if you're a man for predictions, but where do you see this in relation to your theory of enjoyment? Do you see it?
I think we're going to see a worldwide triumph of right-wing enjoyment. Mm. I think we're seeing it.
You know, we've got, is it Geert Wilders in Denmark and
Holland,
Le Pen, yeah. Holland, sorry, and Le Pen.
Le Pen's going to win in France.
And
AfD in Germany.
The UK is fine across the board, by the way. We are just fine. It's a rainy day.
You're fine.
We've got nothing. We've got no charisma. That's the thing, right? So, sorry, I was going to draw on that with what you said about Hillary Clinton. It's interesting that she said, you know, I'm with Hillary. But if you change that to I'm with Trump, you know, like, he's a guy, right?
It's exciting, right?
But Hillary's just not exciting, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know that there was a gender dimension to her defeat for sure. Yeah. But I don't think that it's only a guy. Like, I think the governor of Michigan, who's a woman, I think she has this kind of like, but she has all the clear policies too. But I don't think it's like necessarily, but I mean, I think you could imagine even a female version of Trump. I don't think it's unimaginable.
What would such a person look like?
Well, I think that they would be
Nurse Ratchet.
It'd be interesting. What? No. I think that maybe. I mean, I understand that maybe, but I think they would do this thing where it would be like sexy, but also like really tough, right? Like be
a dominatrix.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, but in some way, manage to amalgamate, like. So that way she appeals to the heterosexual male voters through kind of sexuality, but in the way that Trump does, I think. But also like seems like she's going to be tough in the way that allows them to identify with belonging, right? Like that, like toughness is a...
The future of right-wing politics is getting cucked?
Or being the cucker. Right, like I think
serious. Yeah. I see. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
What would then the left wing thing be in? Like, what's?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not too optimistic about that, James. Like, I think. I mean, in a way, like I wrote this book as a kind of like last gasp. I think. I don't know. Like, I do think that there are. The only thing I think is this is hopeful. Leftist wise, is that there does seem to be some sense that capitalism is worn out or unsatisfying, and so maybe on that level, some kind of like egalitarian project in terms of like I don't know, like a certain kind of living wage for everyone. Something.
I think I think UBI is an inevitability, but I think that's.
You do.
I think so. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not some techno optimist, but it seems to me that, you know, it won't take long for AI to get to a point of just a point where so many jobs will be lost.
And you need people, you need consumers, right?
You need, and, you know, capitalism cannot stop. That's the emphatic thing it cannot do is stop. Right. So, you know, anything to keep up this sort of credit-based illusion.
But that would be a lot of. I mean, the credit is. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's a credit based illusion, but that's going to be a massive expansion of like
absolutely.
Credit, right?
You know, it's a super simplistic appreciation of it. But I saw someone make a comment the other day of money already is completely meaningless. So why don't we just completely like just accept that?
Yeah,
you know, yeah. I don't know. Is there anything you'd like to add about your book? We've ruined politics.
I don't know.
You've ruined politics for people.
I
don't know. People won't, you know, see their own suffering.
Right. I mean, the only thing I would say is I wonder what you think about this. You know, the left-right distinction was created in the middle of the French Revolution as a purely contingent thing, right?
Yeah,
like which side of the monarchy you're sitting. And I wonder if it's maybe used up today. Like, I wonder, and I say this as someone who just wrote a whole book invested in the distinction. And I wonder, I thought this as I was writing it, like, is it maybe time for another way to make the distinction?
I am with you because it, you know, as you said, it starts with the explicit, literally just sitting on either side of the benches. I guess you could just say, as you know, the revolution versus very strict monarchy. And over time, it seems to have been like the left and right means different policies. Like if you say a right wing, you pretty much agree with this set of policies. And if you're left wing, you agree with this set of policies. And it's difficult because one thing that I've tried to write about before, but I could never get into words, is that certain policies which seem non-political and maybe just more social or even ecological get drawn into different sides and people end up being very tribal. So like climate change seems to have just become this a left-wing policy, like in a strange way. So you end up with this weird thing where like people on the right feel they can't support, you know, like you have to double down on all the policies that you find on that side. Same with the left. And a lot of people do the orthogonal thing now, right? Like libertarian is right? I don't know. Why? What's your new...
I don't have a new thing. I just wonder if it's not... I don't know. Like, I wonder if it doesn't end up playing into the very thing that I call right wing politics. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that it kind of if you call it left, people are going to want to oppose it just because they want to oppose what's left. Whereas if they saw maybe what you're saying, they're not necessarily opposed to it, right? Like, so that's all.
I'm agreeing with you, but it's just difficult as, you know, where to go. Because it's almost like, I don't know, just to take a very, like, sort of rough example, you would rarely find, like, an anti-immigration policy, which is like, this is absolutely right-wing, within a left-wing framework. Like, it's just, you know what I mean? So it's like these...
Well, now, but that's not true even 20 years ago.
No, exactly.
Like it used to be the opposite. I mean, it's like climate in a way, but even more extreme, right? Like 20 years ago, it was the right that wanted more open borders because they needed the labor capital needed the cheap labor, right? And even Bernie Sanders here in the US, like 25 years ago, he was like, he said he just vigorously denounced open borders. So it's a weird kind of shift, right? Like it's not, the things aren't written into stone, but you're so right about the way these things, like you once you're identified with the position, then you glom on to all the other positions associated with it. Like climate is a great example. I mean,
climate, well, and also like feminism as well, like, you know,
right.
And it's,
you can't be a right wing feminist. That doesn't even make any sense anymore.
No, I guess it becomes a paradox. But it's sort of like a dangerous politics because it's the equivalent of I mean, it seems like nothing ever gets beyond high school, but it's like the equivalent of peer pressure, right?
Right, right.
And the thing is, as soon as you might say, well, actually, I agree with 90% over here, but 10%, actually, they got good points. It isn't seen as a creation of something new. It's seen as you're like, I don't know, muddying the waters. And so
not
just
only
get
that,
out,
like, James, right. I was just going to say that. So I even know people that were anti-vax, you know?
Hmm.
And so once you take up that one little heresy, then now they've gone totally over to the other side, totally become right wing because yeah. you take that one heresy and then all your friends are like, what are you, crazy? And they reject you. And then you're like, well, wait a minute. These other people are going to accept me. Because, yeah. And then you say, well, oh, well, I think they got a good point about abortion and about climate. And then it snowballs. So I think you're exactly right about the way that function. Awesome. But it's because it's a libidinal category, right? Like it's not a set of policies so much as a way to like libidinally knot your subjectivity together.
What do you mean? But can you expand on that? Sorry, are you good for time?
Yeah, like
are
it's
you
a
okay
sort
for time.
No, I have to go in a couple minutes.
Okay,
but I think it's just like it's a source of enjoyment for the people. Like yeah. That's my point about it. So, and so that's why the actual policies don't ultimately matter. It's can I and that and then I think that's why we're in this. What I would say is a sad situation, because I think the fundamental policy thing that I would associate with emancipation, or what I call it left in the book, but it doesn't have to be called that, is this universal non-belonging, which is, I think, egalitarian, and which I think everyone can ultimately get on board with, right? So I don't think it's necessarily something that has to, that you would only oppose it if you identify it with this thing that's kind of crazy and, you know, problematic because it's attached to all these other kinds
yeah.
of things that you
yeah.
are against.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, there we go. Where can we find your book?
I don't know, where is it? Sublation
Media.
Sublation Media.
Be on Amazon yeah. and all these lovely
Amazon. Big yeah, yeah, all those nice big capital. Yeah.
No, I'm sure you can find it all local bookstores and local political bookstores and this kind of thing. So I'll put links for Enjoyment Right and Left in the description below. What are you working on now?
Well, James, I just finished that Lacan thing, and then I have yeah. a book called it's called Pure Excess, Capitalism mm-hmm. and the Logic and Commodity Form.
Who are you drawing on in? Is there any Bataille or?
That's a good, that's a great question, actually. No, it's kind of psychoanalytic. It's still okay. psychoanalytic about okay. excess.
Okay.
But Marx, I mean, a lot about Marx and surplus value. So it's really, it's not, I think it's my most Marxist, like influenced by Marx himself.
When's that going to be released?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's at Columbia. I think early next year, maybe.
Okay. Wow. I'd love to talk to you about it when it's released.
Oh, yeah. It'd be great to talk about it.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, it's a good place to finish up. Todd McGowan.
Great to
Thanks
see
very
you.
Much.
Appreciate it. Take care.